So maybe we should continue from where we left yesterday. So we talked about the syntax requirements, some of the in XML there are some very hard requirements when it comes to characters where we can use certain characters, and that we have entity or elements that need to be properly nested, properly closed. We need quotes around attribute values. There are a number of requirements. There are some requirements also when it comes to XML names. XML names are, for instance, the names of tags, the tag names, elements. And this is mostly relevant when we design a new XML document type or format. The requirements are that you can use letters, numbers, underscore, dashes, and dots, but the first character has to be either a letter or an underscore. That's usually not the big issue, except that we may sometimes want to use numbers, and unfortunately we can't start an element name with a number if we wanted to. So it will have to be so either underscore or a letter. We can't use XML, those three characters one after the other in that order, as the start or a prefix of any name. Uppercase, lowercase, it doesn't matter. XML, because the ones who develop the XML standard, the web consortium, they will like to keep XML whatever form for later use. So they have the possibility to use it for their own sake. So we can't use XML as the prefix for our own elements. So we can use Norwegian characters if you want to. May not be a good idea, because it might be hard for someone with who don't have a Norwegian keyboard to actually type in element names, but that's doable. We can use dashes, we could use underscore at the beginning, we could use numbers and dots in the middle of a name. But we can't use anything with a dollar sign, we can't have spaces in a name, and we can't start the name with a number. These are just the rules. If you break the rules, then it's gonna complain. So when we work with let me see, I was doing this one first. When we work with XML and these technologies, the browser is the tool that we can use for testing. And so if you're trying to do an XML document like this and save it. And if I go to, let's see, it wasn't open, was it? I don't have my server running. No, it's a test of XML. Let's see my HD docs. Test of XML. So it says invalid element name, because I can't start with a number. So we use our browsers to test whatever we want to test, to verify that our documents are fine. And we can't do XML demo, because XML as a prefix, it's reserved for future use. As I said yesterday as well, there are these entity references, less than, greater than, ampersand, quote, an apostrophe. The ones we really need will be less than an amp, because these have specific meaning, but for completeness and for convenience, the XML or the web consortium added these other ones. If we want to refer to special characters like the copyright or the euro or alpha, we can then use the Unicode number. So even if you remember yesterday, in HTML, we do have certain entity references for the Norwegian characters, for copyright, for some of the other characters. In XML, we don't have it, but we can still add basically any character we want by using the Unicode number as a reference. So we have the hash sign, which says that this is the Unicode number for that character. And as in specific document types, in specific applications of XML, we may define our own entity references. As we said, in HTML, we do have the Norwegian A, Ø, and Å this way. Text in XML document is parsed. Most places in the document, the text is parsed. What does that mean? It means that this text, Harry Appels S, Amp Johnny Appels S, if you write that text, it will be parsed by the APIs and presented as the related characters. So if you try in here to do. Oops, sorry. To do Harry and then sorry. Harry's. And we go to the browser and reload. We don't see the character entity because it's being parsed by the reader, the XML reader. So it's being replaced here. Just a second. But if you go and look at the source is still. So that character is still there in the source. But when presented, when we deal with it, what we get will be the character instead of the reference to the character. Question? Det kan vi gjøre, vet du. Se om jeg får den her større. Jeg ikke sikker på om jeg ikke har den. Skal vi se her. I don't know. Doesn't get much bigger. Sorry. If we have large pieces, long pieces of texts, it's sometimes quite hard to read all this, so it might be useful to present the data as they are. So with the C data, then everything will be presented as characters, which means that if we want to see the ampersands, we want to see the less than signs, then we could use a C data, because otherwise we'd have to write amp, less than, and all the references. Yeah, I was. We could clean that up, but it's basically already here, so it's not much of an exercise. When it comes to comments we would enclose in this sequence of characters. We can't put comments within a tag, so if we try to here say that we would like to add a comment here, and then we try to reload, it did actually accept it. But still, it's, oh yeah, sorry, this is a source. Sorry, yeah, it has to. So if we reload this one. Yeah. So it's error in parsing the attribute name because it found a comment in there. And we can't have double hyphens inside. It has to be at the very end. Comments are for users. And as I said yesterday, if you need to pass information to applications, we use the processing instructions with the question marks. And we can pass information to the applications. So here, we could just add comment in here, and it will appear in the document for human readers. This wouldn't be, as we tested, this is not valid, and it's not legal to put in double dashes in the middle either. Processing instructions, like the PHP or ASP, is enclosed with the less than question mark, and ending with greater than a question mark, or question mark greater than. The target, it would follow. Target will then be what identifies the application that is to process this. So when we do PHP, any container that is able to process PHP will be activated and will get the whatever we send there. So this is how we send code to the PHP container inside the web server. If you remember, we have the web server and we have the PHP processor. And when we get PHP code, a file with .php, whenever the web browser finds PHP, takes whatever it finds here and passes it to the PHP processor. And the PHP processor executes, writes to the output, and contacts the database, whatever it needs to do. And comments, as I said, might be used. We could think of having that, but that would mean that it would be much harder to separate what goes to programs and what would go to end users. So we had CPHP before. It's everything goes in between here. So in this case, we're checking if the user is logged in by looking at the session object to see if there's a logged in value there. And if not, we redirect to the login page, ask them to log in. Now let's go and look more into the XML tree structure and a little bit about character sets. So this is the XML document, the SVG, defs, the linear gradient that we looked at yesterday. If we look at this from a tree perspective, we always have one root. And as you can see here, the children will be defs that ends here and rect that ends here. And then we can see the defs will have linear gradients and stop as the children. And through the algorithmic methods, you are now looking at tree traversal. So this is really just a traversing of the tree that you get by doing this here. The tree structure is basically what we see in the web browser. Again, the web browser is your tool. As we see, it recognizes the XML vocabulary, and we got some error messages if you break the basic XML requirements. And it does have a style sheet that it presents it in a nice way. I don't know if you use what browser you're using, but if you use Firefox, then there is a download that you can do, Firepath, but with Chrome it comes automatically. Question? Okay. Okay. So they have stopped Firebug. And I haven't used Firefox in a while. We could check to see if it has native support now. It's native, okay, yeah. So that's so then they're standardizing, so we don't have the difference between the two. So if we go to, then the browser and look at one of the larger documents. This one, for instance, now it's presented as a tree structure. So I collapsed the branches. So top level, the root is nutrition. I can open it. I can look at the node daily values that has these children. And we can look at the food that has a number of children and vitamins. And I can close and I can open. So the browser is making this into a tree. So we can look at it as a tree. But if you look at the page source, it is the same text file that we've seen before. So it's the browser that helps us make this into a tree structure, which is quite convenient. When we develop, then we can test that the results is what we are expecting. So I'll update my slide then about Firebug and Firefox. Character sets. They used to be a big problem. They still is a little bit. So I don't know if you, in the first assignment, tried to print out from the database to console, and sometimes the Norwegian characters appear with strange encoding. Because it's on the web, traditionally, it's been the ISO 8859, called ISO Latin, that's been used as a default encoding. But for XML, the choice was for UTF-8. And then whenever we go from one character set to the other, the same character code represents different characters. So it means that when we send the character codes from one system to the other, we may all of a sudden see a different character than what we think, because the same number is being used for different characters in different character sets and different codings. So as we try now to stick with UTF-8 in the database, in the server app, in the XML, in the coding, and if we can stick to UTF-8 throughout the whole chain, then we are fine. But sometimes there is one link that would use some other encoding, and then we are really messed up again. The final introductory concept is about namespaces, and I'm not sure if you did do a lot of namespace in the programming courses, but namespaces are also being used in programs, and we saw it a little bit in PHP, because PHP is starting to use namespaces. We didn't make much of it, but a little bit, and the same concept here. So the thing is that if you like to combine two different XML applications, let's say you have a database or a document that has information about a person, and the person has a title, and some name. Now, if you are to use Dublin Core specifies that the title is the title of something that's constructed. It has a meaning. So if you have a document, or you have a piece of art, or you have a photo, then title is something that is man-made. And then you can have whoever made it and the date and everything. Now, if you in the same document would like to say that sometimes I refer to the title of something that the books that this person made, you would like to use the Dublin Core meaning of title, but sometimes it's the person's title, which is the educational background. And those two titles are different. This one you can't say that this is a professor when you look at a piece of art. The title is something like the Mona Lisa or something like that. So in one and the same document, we may want to say that this is Dublin Core title, and this is the professional title. For doing that, we need to be able to distinguish the different tags, elements, attributes, whatever we have, so that we can combine in one and the same document, use different what's called vocabularies, different XML tags. And this is what namespace is for, because what you do then is to say, okay, we have a namespace here for person information, and we have a namespace here for Dublin Core vocabulary. And whenever we refer to the tag, we have to say, what is the namespace that defines this this element? And the same in programming, you may want to use code from different libraries, and you have, unfortunately, two class names that are the same, and you would like to use both class names. To avoid that problem, you can use namespace to say, okay, now I talk about the class person in that library or namespace, and I talk about the person in a different one. I can combine the two in one and the same program. So in XML, what we do is that we have the XML NS prefix here that says that this is a namespace. And what comes afterward, the DC, is a prefix, because the namespace is really a long URI, HTTP, Perl.org, DC, elements, 1.1. This is the Dublin Core namespace. And this URI is what defines the namespace. For convenience, we often like to do a short version of prefix. So DC here is something that we define in this document to be a quick reference to that namespace. So we can separate the namespaces without having to write in this whole long full namespace name. The scope of a prefix is the subtree under the element where the namespace is defined. So here, since we define the namespace and the description node, all descendants of the description node will be in that namespace, unless we state something else. It's defined in there, so we can use it in there. But outside, we will have to define it separately. We can reference through the prefix. So here, if you define the DC prefix as this Dublin Core namespace, then we say the title we refer to is a Dublin Core title. The creator we refer to is a Dublin Core creator. This is also Dublin Core creator, and this is Dublin Core date. Then these tags are from that very specific. So if we had another title, we could just do title, and that will be in our own namespace. If we don't have any namespace, it will be kind of in the global namespace. Then we compete with everybody else. So if you think about, you have a collection of books, and for one book we have a description, and we define the namespace, then the prefix DC is defined and can be used in that subtree. Namespaces make everything a bit harder when it comes to, when we talk about DTDs, when we talk about XPath, but they are very convenient for when we want to mix and merge various vocabularies. And they consist of the two parts, the qualified name is the whole thing, okay? The prefix is the first part that we can use for convenience. We don't have to refer to the whole thing, but the real name would be what it is bound for to. And the local part is just the title or the person or whatever we would use without thinking about the namespace. The prefix has to be a valid XML name, which we just talked about. It has to start with underscore and letter. And we can add in the middle, we can have dashes and dots as well, and numbers, but we can't use XML as a prefix. Then the question is, what is this URI? You have heard about URLs. L stands for location. It means where a certain object is stored. So the URL is where we find documents and videos and images. Now, what is a URI? Where the I is for identifier. So the URI is a kind of an abstract concept in the sense that it defines something. So if you look at the URI for the Dublin Core, it's HTTP, perl.org, DC, elements, 1.1. That's the URI. Which means that if we put it into our web browser, there may not be a real document there because it's not a location. So there may not be anything stored there. But it's a good practice to store a description of the namespace in there, because the URI is, the idea here is that it's unique, so that whenever we refer to perl.org, DC elements, 1.1, this is the only one that exists. This is the one. So whenever we refer to it, we know that we refer to Dublin Core. So it has to be unique. That's why it's the I. Whether there is something stored on that address or not, that's not important. But, as I said, it's good practice to use URLs and store something meaningful there so that those who want to use it can find it. So it has to be unique, and it's a good practice to actually store something. If you were to define URIs, then the question is a question of naming authority. Who has the authority to define a unique name? Because we need a scheme that we can create unique names. So for me, for instance, if I want to create something, if I do HTTP, ntnu.no, that's NTNU, so no one outside NTNU can use that for an address. And if I do IMT2571, I'm the boss. I rule here in my kingdom, a small kingdom. So under here, I can create whatever names I want because it's mine. So if you have your own domain, or you go and student and then some student number, as long as it's something that is unique to you, you own it, then you can rule and you can define whatever in that namespace. So that's the best way to create a namespace, is to make sure that this address, this domain is owned by someone, and you have within that larger kingdom, you have a small part that you own, because then you can create it to guarantee that it's unique, because this one assumes that the namespaces, I mean these URIs, are unique. And the best way is then to use a URL, and that URL is in your control. Then you are fine. We also have the possibility of default namespace. So if you have a big document, rather than saying DC colon for all the elements, we can just say the default one. So what you see here is that we just say namespace equals to. We don't define a prefix that we can use to refer to it. In this case, we say that everything under here is from the SVG namespace. So this would be the default namespace. That's why we do it this way. This is really the intro. You find a little bit about it in a textbook. Not a lot, but in chapter 30, there's a little bit about XML. But I suggest you'd rather go to the XML tutorials and this document here. They are also linked in Blackboard. You find the links there in Blackboard under resources. So I recommend that you read this for the details, because XML is a web technology, and the web is where you find information about the web technologies. Okay, then we'll start on XPath. So what we have established so far is that XML is a tree structure, and XPath is a language for identifying nodes in the tree structure. So it's kind of a query language, but it's kind of a simple query language. So because of that, there is also an XQuery, which is a more powerful query language, built on top of XML. But XPath is the first and best tool for the simple applications. And when you next week or even on Friday, when you start going into the document object model, we're going to traverse documents, find information in the document, then XPath is a good tool. A little bit about motivation for XPath and why we spend time on it here. And then we're going to go into what's called location paths. And I hope that all of you are quite familiar with the file paths on the file system, because this is quite similar to that, although it extends it quite a lot. And then we can put predicates and use some functions on the path to pick some nodes, not all in the path, but some nodes. And at the very end, we look at the more complete way of identifying nodes, because the what's called the abbreviated path don't give us the full access to all dimensions of an XML document. So that's why we have some abbreviated paths that would allow us to iterate the documents in even more advanced ways than what we could do in the abbreviated ones. So the XPath is, as I said, a way to identify a part of a document. And when you say a part of a document, it doesn't have to be from to. A part can be a bit here and a bit there from everywhere. But anyway, we are able to identify either a complete document, which is not very exciting, or we can do a part. It could be a single node, a single attribute, it could be a subtree, it could be several subtrees, it could be several nodes spread all over around in the document. And there are many different uses of it. We're going to talk about XML schema in a couple of weeks, which is how we can define the document structure and leave it to a parser to validate that our document is correctly formatted. And here we have possibility to define keys and define elements to be unique. There we're going to use XPath to define what's going to be unique and what the scope is for the XML schema definitions. In XSLT, which we're just going to briefly talk about, it's a tool and language for transforming XML into other formats. And here we have the pattern matching and the selection, and also in XQuery. XLink and XPointer, they have relations. They store links in an explicit way, and the relations bound to a link, we use XPath for that. You will most likely be using XPath if you make XML programs and you parse and deal with XML files. You're going to pick information that's stored in a configuration file or another file. That's what you're going to do in the next assignment. I'm going to give you a long XML file and you're going to pick up, get all the information in there and store it in the database. And can traverse the document in other ways as well, but as we talk about when we come to DOM, but XPath is a convenient way to retrieve the piece of information that you need from the document. And then you're going to see many other uses of it. When we talk about XPath, we need to think about what are the different types of nodes that may exist in XML document. And this also leads a little bit into the document object model that we're going to deal with next week, in that XPath identifies types of nodes, and in the DOM, these are the classes and APIs that are provided for accessing the information. The first one is the root. As I said, all if you have the nutrition, you have the root, you have nutrition as the first child, which is kind of the root element. And then under nutrition, we have daily values, and we have food. So the root is at the very top, and it has one element, which is called the document element, which is kind of the parent of all other elements and everything else in the tree. Elements are really the building blocks for a tree structure. We have the attributes. The attributes are only bound to elements. So we can have an attribute here, the type of food. We have text elements, as we discussed yesterday. Food, I don't remember, it has name and under name. We have text values. So these are also nodes in the structure, but these will have text will have to be leaf nodes. They have to be at the very bottom. They can't be, they don't have any children. They can be mixed with other siblings, but they can't have any children. We have namespace nodes. So here, for instance, we can attach a namespace to the nutrition if you wanted to. And these are nodes that we can, in XPath query, we have processing instructions and commands. So these are different types of nodes, and XPath gives us tool to address and to identify these different types of nodes. What is a location path? It is very similar to a file system path in that root is here. It's the first child of root. It's the grandchild. It's the great-grandchild of root. And we can have relative paths, which is BC, and if we are in the A, our context node is in the A node, then BC will be the ABC branch, if you want. And as with the file system, you can use wildcards, which means any child, not just B childs, but no children, but any child. One big difference in the file system, so if you have user bin, you can't have multiple files with the same name or multiple, so you can't have DB, DB, DB as three children of user bin in the file system. They have to be unique. But in XML, there is no such restriction. You can have many B children, which means that a path identifies a list of nodes. So a path would typically be a group of nodes, not just one node that you would have in a file system. In the file system, you can do with the wildcard, you can get a list of files as well. But you can't have several of the same directory name or the same file name in the same, let's say, folder. But in XML, you obviously can. And that makes the processing a bit different. And we have to think about every time that even if there's just one file, we know that just one child here, what we get back would always be a list with one element. So, and we have extended capabilities. We're going to go in depth in a little while. And the one of the useful ones is that we can do a double slash. And double slash means, so if you have something like this, and we do double slash C, it will find all the C's, doesn't matter where they are, all the C's, that C and that C, are all descendants of this document, the root of the document. So in XPath, it's quite a convenience function to say, give me all descendants of a certain document or of a certain node. And we look for, it doesn't matter what they're named or where they are positioned, we're going to find them all. And we are able to pick out specifically certain types of nodes, like commands or texts. And we can navigate beyond parent-child. We can go to siblings, we can go in different ways, jumping up and down, as we're going to be looking at. And as I said, it evaluates to a node list, which means that it's not going to be just one node, but it will be a list of nodes, and the nodes will, in most cases, be sorted in the order of the document, which appear in the document. The only exception we'll talk about when it comes to details, the only exception is that they might be sorted backwards if our searching is backward searching. So we can search up the tree or to previous nodes in the tree. In that case, they are sorted in reverse order. They are always sorted, usually in document order, sometimes in the inverse order, depending on the function that we use. There will never be duplicates. So even though there might be multiple ways to the same C, that C won't appear several times in the list. It would appear only once, even if it satisfies several of the requirements. So either a node is included or it's not. So in that case, it's kind of a set. But since it has an order, it's ordered in document order, then it's not a true set. It's that's why we call it a list. But that list has no duplicates. So what we talk about as steps in a location will be each of these. So this is the first step, second step, third, fourth, fifth step in the path. And each step has a path here, but we could, as I said, we could make this into double, which means that any descendant, which is a C descendant, and any children D and C of that one. So the path is either child or descendant. And then we have what we call a node test. In this case, the node test is it has to be an element with name A. It has to be an element with name D. But the node test might also be that it's a comment or it's some text or it's an attribute. And on top of all of that, we can add predicates. So we could say we are only interested in the bees having a certain characteristic, and with this, the having some characteristic, and this having some characteristics. We're going to go through all the details, but think of the three elements. It's the path, typically child-parent relationship, but it may be descendant. Then the node that can test for whether it's an attribute, an element with a certain name, or all of them, or it's a text node. Any of the seven types of nodes we can use in the node test. And then on top of all that, we may add predicates one or multiple places in the whole path. Let's see, I think that might be a good place to take a break, is it? So it will look something like this. In this case, we are looking for all food elements. We don't care where they are, but there should be an element food in this document. Should have a child, which is an element with name. And we are only interested in those names where the dot, which is the name, where the name actually contains chicken. So you remember from file systems that dot is the current node and dot dot is the parent node. You can use the same here. So if you want to refer to the current node, which is the name of the food, then you say, okay, the name of the food should contain the text chicken. That's what this means. We're going to go through this in many examples after the break. Any questions before the break? Nope. So this is what we're gonna, these are basic building blocks. We have the paths, and we have the node test, saying what type of node specifically we're looking for, or even as with a specific name, and possibly some predicates, only those nodes that satisfy a certain condition. In the browsers, there, or in JavaScript, there is a function called $x, where we can put in the path, and then it will find the nodes, that the list of nodes that satisfy the path that we have specified. We may put in a context node. As you know, in the file system, you have a current directory, and you can go up and down, and you can list. And if you list files with star, it's going to be the children of that directory. The same thing here. You can have your query relative to a context node. In that case, we pass the context node here. And remember that the result is always a list, even if we have only one node. So, for instance, if you go to the to this document, we can bring up the developer's tools. So if you go here, and more tools, developer tools, then we get the toolbar for developer tools. And here in the console, we can interact, putting up JavaScript, calling JavaScript. So here, we can call the function $x. We can, and then this is what we do. We put in the whatever we query for in here. And if we interested in let's try to see what the root is. So we list all the children at the very top. Then you find that this is HTML, which is not the root of the XML, because if you remember what we said before, the browser, what the browser does, it attaches a style to it, and it attaches it to an HTML document and a style to it. So when we use the browser, we can't really access the XML structure from the very top, as it would be if we had it in our program. If you loaded it with DOM, then we would have access to root node. In this case, the root node is kind of hidden or low into the HTML tree. So what we can do to get the root or the top of the document is, to get the root, we can do somewhere there is a nutrition, because that's the name of my document or the XML document. So this is what I want to do, be the root, or actually the parent to this one. I want to be the root. So I can do this. Oops. I forgot the X. Now, you can see here that this is a list. But I'm not interested in the list. I'm interested in the node itself. So I can set my root, make a variable root, and set root to be $x. Nutrition. And I would like it to be the first element. Now, this is nutrition, and if I make it the parent of nutrition, that's kind of where my root is. Now the first child will be the root element of the tree. Do you follow me? So this is the last. So when I have my document, this is root, and the first element, the document element, is nutrition, and then we have the children. And this now is linked to the HTML document. So I'm right now at the parent of nutrition, meaning that this is what would be the document root if I had this loaded in a program that loaded XML directly. But this is what now it's attached to the DOM or to the tree of the browser. Because what I can do now is now I can list the children, but then relative to what is my root. Now you see the nutrition is there. You follow me? So I created a root context node saying this is my context node, which then should be really the top of the tree if it had been loaded in some XML API. But now since it's attached to the browser tree, it is kind of midway up here. But if I query, if I put up XPath expressions relative to this parent node, then it will be the same as if I just access the XML document directly. So that's what this is about. Three things. Number one, the X function. Number two, the context node. Number three, if we want to use a specific node, we need to pick out the specific node from the node list, because all XPath expressions will return, not all, but the ones that will list files like this. We're going to go to some aggregate functions where we get some numbers out as well. But anything that would return an element or an attribute will always return a list, even if it is just one. So we need to go in the list and pick the first object, if that's what we're looking for. Is this okay? So we are trying now to go through this this document and or a document and try to see what we will be finding based on different types of combinations of paths and node tests. So this is the example tree. If you go to Blackboard, I uploaded a nutrition example. I didn't upload this one because it's not a very useful tree in its own right. But it is. I do have made an XML version of it. So if you want, I can put it up on Blackboard as well, and you can play with it just to see the tests for or test some of the slides and see how it works. But we can play with it here. So this is a tree. A has two B children and an H child. So here it has one B, one B, one H. So it's kind of the same. What I did here, just to help us when we find results, is I did add some IDs so that when we look at the ID, we know which B or C or D or A we got. So for convenience, but that's not shown in the tree in the slide set. So if we want to find the root, it is slash A. I can't do the slash in this example because we have to be relative to the HTML tree that is on top of us. But if we go to the developer tools and we want to find the top, now what we would do here would be similar to in a file system. We would say, okay, it's not the real top, but it's the top from where we are. And then we find a nutrition child. Oops. I need to set the context. So let's do the same here. Root equals X. And we need to find some A, the first A, and the object. Sorry. So that's the A. And now we can go back to that one. Oops. In the context of the root that we had. Oops, still no. No, sorry. It wasn't A. Sorry. Root should be A. Parent. Oops. Not A. No, not nutrition. I'm looking for A. Sorry, I was confused with the other one. There you go. And if we want that specific node, we pick up the first one in the result set. So that's the A. That's the root of the document. And I would have to be relative to the context node since we have this big tree on top of us. So to find all the children's or children of the root node, we can just then do A and then all the children. And we may not want to find just the first one. So here we see that there are two B's and one H. I'm not so sure why Chrome is doing this, but just pay attention to, in this list, they use all lowercase. And we were saying that in XML, every name is case sensitive. But this is just a local placeholder within Chrome. So if we go and click here, we bring up the node, and then we can look at the first node, the content. Oh, let me see. And we can find that children, it goes to links to the children. Local name is B, capital B. So this is just a reference to the node that is in lowercase. So it is, I thought it kind of confusing, but because I thought it would be better if they stayed with the, kept the casing, but they don't. So in this list, this B is a lowercase of the name, but it's just a reference internally in Chrome. Question? Yeah. It's probably that's the way it does it, but anyway, it's we can find from the ID, because the hash here says that what comes after is the ID of the node, and so I have the IDs here, so I can see that the 1 1, this is this B, 1 2 is this B, and then the H is one lower. So this way we can see that we are in line with the tree structure here, and then if you just want the B children. Then, of course, we can have a different node test. So rather than any node, we just want the B nodes. And then the H node is gone. And we can find the children of the B's of A, in the same way as we would do in the file system. We just go deeper and deeper. And this A, in difference to the file system, this A has two Bs, so it's all the children of both of the Bs. So this is now the list that we're going to get is this list. So A, B, star. Let me see, we find that the two C's and the one D. This C, and this D would be the direct children of B's that are direct children of the A that we started with. If we don't care about the child of A, it could be any of the children, we include the H, but the H doesn't have a C child. In this case, only the first B will have a C child or C children. So that's why we just get these two here. I don't know why I drew the line over here. Should probably fix that, because the result set is just those two that are highlighted here. If I want to find any C, it will search and go through the whole. Oh, there was a C, there's a C, there's a C. That's all. It will traverse the whole tree, like you have been doing in the algorithmic methods. Traversing the tree, visiting all the nodes, and looking for Cs. If it finds a C, it will put into the result set. And here comes a note of caution. Be a bit different. Be a bit careful about what's happening. Because B and A slash B may give you the same result. If you know that all your Bs are children of A, or even if they are deep down. So let's say you have a you have an A, B, C, D, E, F. Something like this. If you want this F, it's very convenient for a programmer to say F, which is the same as A, B, C, D, E, F. This is more work for the programmer. This is more work for a computer. Because if you do slash slash F, it means that we have to look for this one, go through all the children, go through the first all children, go to first, go all the way down here, and then look for this branch and this branch. And if this branch happened to be huge, we have to visit all. Because with slash slash F, it will have to visit the whole tree. If we do A, B, C, D, F, is just going to visit this branch, or these two branches are the only ones that will be visited. So we don't, and we're going to stop here as soon as we can't go on further. Yeah? Yes, so this one you would use if you have that H has an F, or A has an F, and we like all Fs. That's the proper use of this one, if you don't know where the node is. But if you know that all the nodes you're interested in will be children of an E, then this is lazy, and it might be very costly, because the program will have to visit all nodes to look for all Fs, because the real purpose is, as you say, it is to find all Fs, irrespective of where they're stored. That's the good purpose. That's how they should be used. But often, in exam, you don't want to write these long strings. You just do slash slash. It's lazy. It's okay. It gives the right result. But in performance, if you do this as a habit in a huge XML file, and what you know is, especially if you just do slash slash B rather than A slash B, because here you really need to just visit these nodes to satisfy or to test for this, but in this this one, but in this case, the computer will have to go through all, even though we know that it's a grandchild of the root node. So be careful. It's a convenience function, but don't use it just for convenience. Use it when you know that the nodes are going to be on different places in the hierarchy, because if you know exactly their position, take the extra work and write it out with the explicit path. This is also this. There are cases in which, I think I had one exam question once, in which if the D is optional, it means that you may have a B, it has a C, and it has an E and an F. You know that it's a child of E, but you don't know if it's a D in the middle or not. In that case, you also could put in, so you can do an A, B, C, E, F. So you don't know if there's a D there or not. You are as specific as you can. You don't know if there's a D or not. That's why you do say any, but then you only look for here in the subtree, and it will actually have to look for that E, see if there's an E here. So you still have to do search for E's, but it will stop as soon as it can. So it won't search the whole tree, just the part under there where you have the optional nodes. So don't use it just for convenience. Use it when there are optional nodes, or what you're looking for might be in different places in the tree, different parents, different types of parents. So, finding all F nodes. What do we do? all F nodes. Descendant of the root. That would give us all. It goes through the hole and picks up all the Fs. And as you see here, they're going to be returned in sorted order because this one is first, second, third, fourth, fifth level and the number. So it goes 1, 2, 3 and then to the next branch. 2 and then the next higher branch here. So it returns the results in the order they are visiting the tree because it does a traversal, tree traversal from going through the left branches first and then to the right, going through the hole. And then it, as it visits, it meets the nodes, it's going to put them in. And as you see, it's probably not here, but it will put in parents before the children. F nodes having a C parent. How would we do that? Not all F nodes, but only the F nodes having a C parent. Okay. Then we don't know where the C is, though. So some C has an F, and we're interested in the F, but it has to have a C parent. It's just one that has a C parent in this case. If you look at the tree here, this F has a C parent, these Fs has an e, have E parents, this has an E parent, this has an E parent. Find that node. The question is whether we want it uniquely or the path to that node, because we can specify the path, but it may be several of those nodes. In this case, it's just one. So if you do ABDC as the path, that would be, sorry. So A/B/D/C. And then we want that specific node. So that's the C one that we called 121. Let's see if this was the one we were looking for. 1211. It has a BD, ABDC. We're going to come a little bit longer. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it today or on Friday, and talk about positions in the sets. We could also find the first and third and second child. It's probably just going to be right around the corner when we come to talk about predicates. Relative paths, when we do EF, then it's all based on the context node. So if we change... So if we do add a new context node, let's see, context equals $x. So let's see, it was, we can, yeah, let's just do an A here. A, what was the rest of the specification? Let's see, sorry. A, B, C, E. It was actually A, B, C. And the first one, the first A, B, C. So it's A, B, C. Sorry. And the first one. So that's the 111 node. And we're going to find the F children, grandchildren, or the F children of E child. So it is from there. So we're going to do A, E, F. Now from the context node. So these were the three children of that context node. Because now the context node is this C here. And we look for the E. Sorry, is it? No, it's the higher up. So it's the context node is this C. So we go through all the E children to find all the F of those E's. And those were the three that we found. Nothing special. I mean, it's like the file system. The only thing is that what we get is not one file. We get a whole list every time, even if it's just one. And we can get a parent. So if we here, sorry, there. If rather than here, go for the parent of the context node, and then we'll see what node that is. It's that B11B, because this was the context node and this is the parent. Nothing too exciting if you have been using the file system a lot. And from the context node, relative path, because if you do //, you're going to find all. Maybe we'll look at that. So if here in the context node, if we do descendants F. Now, descendants of what? This will be descendants of root, because we are, in this case, when we do a slash, we are all the way up. I mean, if you do CD/, you start from the very top. Wherever you are, you start from the top. If you do CD/bin, it depends on where you are. But CD/, it would all be from the top. The same here. This will give us all Fs. Sorry, I don't have to add the first one. All the Fs. If you want the Fs that are children or descendants, sorry, of the context node, we need to say start the search in the context node and all descendants of the context node. Dot is the context node. It's the current node. And we search the tree that starts here. And then we just get just the three Fs that are descendants of the context node. So that'll be clarifying. It's the same as if you do, have you tried it? Do CD/bin and CD.bin. .bin will look in the current directory to see if it finds a bin directory. And this one will go to the very root and see if the root of the system you have a bin directory. So same thing here, just that we use the descendants rather than child. Same with absolute path A, B, same thing. So if we, from the context node, going to look for A, we can't do it here actually, because we have HTML on top here. Sorry, we have HTML on top. So top is HTML. Or not? What was top? Do you remember what that was? Let's do this then to figure out what the top is. Oh, it was HTML. That was interesting. I don't know. Not what we expected. But okay, anyway, if you had the whole tree in the API and we didn't have the browser playing with you, then with the dash you would go all the way to the top. In this case, that's the HTML part, so it's harder to trace it. And absolute path for F that we already looked for. These are the six nodes that we already found. Okay, so that's where the paths, how we go up and down and connect them in a composite path. Now, when we talk about context, we use the context node. When we talk about the context, you have this context node. And within the context, nodes have position. So I could find the first node, or the second node, or the third node. So, and the numbering, in this case, is... So if you go to the EFs, and if I want to just find the second child, now the position is doesn't start with zero. In XPath, as in SQL, we start with one, position one. So the first position is one. So this will give us the second node, and so we can just find this F node is the second one, because you remember the first one was 1111. This is the second one. So there is a position. So nodes have a position in the set, position among the children, a position in the tree, and there is also a size. So we can also find the last position of the last element in the set. And there is possibly namespaces related to it, because it might be that these elements define namespaces. So that's part of the context that surrounds us when we work with these nodes. When it comes to node tests, we can find text, and we can find commands, we can find processing instructions, and we can find nodes. And nodes would be the same as searching for a star. That would be. So if we go to this one, we can, rather than searching for a star, we can search for comment. Oops. We need any commands. They can be anywhere. So we have one command in here, which is child of nutrition. That's why it didn't come up here. It wasn't child of the root. It was child of, or the context root. It was child of nutrition. And we can find all texts. Sorry. All the texts. Now they will appear as text. So if you just for the fun of it, let's say the fourth, or actually the fifth in this case, text, then that's 65. So this is a way to get the actual texts as well. Otherwise, we get the elements. Now we can get the actual text, because these are nodes in the tree as anything else. Everything in XML will be part of the tree, as we talk about when we talk about DOM. And the at sign is for querying attributes. So here we have an attribute type for food. There's an attribute type. So I can find all types by saying there is an attribute type, and I can find all of them. If I want to find all attributes, we just use the wildcard after the. So there are some ID attributes, there are unit attributes, there are total fats. The total fat units, there are, you can see there are a number of attributes type among them. Remember, for element, just element name. For attributes, we start with the at sign. For text, it's a text function. For commands, we have a command function that will identify it. So this means any element, any attribute, elements with that name, attributes with that name. And then for namespace, We can use the star for namespace, or we can find any elements within the namespace, where this is the prefix of the namespace. So this is how we can test for what nodes go into our path. Is it any node? Is it only the B nodes? Would it be only attributes? What would go in the test? Then, yeah, the attributes are referenced using the prefix. And we separate elements and attributes with the kind of with the slash, as we will separate the parents and children. So to find the F IDs, so we can find, let's go back, do we have here? So if we want to find, let's do from the context, no, well, let's do all Fs, let's just get rid of this. The IDs, not the elements themselves, but the IDs of these elements, or the F elements, then we get all the IDs as a set. So this way we can get the IDs, and from the IDs we can get the element they belong to, and we can traverse the tree. Because this is the idea. In when you deal with XML and process XML, you use XPath to find some node, but remember that that node is in the tree. So once you get a node, from there we can traverse and get to everywhere else we want to. So we just need a handle somewhere. We could always start from the top and go down, but if we look for something specific, from there we can find the parents, grandparents, we can find what it belongs to, and traverse all around the tree, because they're all connected, as we're going to see more next week. Then we can start looking at predicates. Because what we can do so far is we can say what nodes in terms of their names or the type, is it text that you're looking for, is it an attribute you're looking for, is it an element, and how are the elements in the tree structure in terms of what are the parents and how they are connected in the path. But sometimes we are interested in just a subset of those elements. They will have a certain, we won't put a certain restriction, they have a certain characteristics that we want to test on, and that's what we do in the predicate. So in our path, we can add predicates at each level, each step. We can say we want the bees, only the bees with this requirement, and they we look for their CD children, but only those Ds having this feature, and the E and F, and only those Fs. So we can put predicates wherever we want at each step in the XPath expression. So yeah, this is a document, and the document is built up of is nutrition. It's built up of two parts. I think I'd rather show you the one that we were looking at in the browser. So it has two parts. The first part is daily values, where it lists in an average person's meal how much carb there should be, how much fiber there should be, how much protein you should have, how much sodium in the daily recommended daily values. And then for each of the different types of food here, we have food. I just added some attribute vegetable attribute type. That could be vegetable or meat or fish or some. I just came up with some typing here. And then you have the name of the food, the manufacturer, how big a serving is, how many calories per serving total, and from fat, how much fat, saturated fat, how much cholesterol, sodium, carbo, fiber, protein. So that is the structure of the yeah. And we have vitamins A and C, minerals, calcium, and iron. That's how each of the entries, food entries, look like. So, in the test, we may look for food, but not all food, but only food that actually contains vitamin A. So it has that node. Now, in our case, they all have vitamin A, but the number may be zero, because this tests for the presence of an A attribute, and I think that the A attribute is probably everywhere, but it's just set to zero. So in this case, it's not so fruitful test. But we could test whether a certain attribute is present. So if we do this, let's see, we're gonna find nutrition, food, where vitamins A is defined. And as I said, I think that's going to be for all of them. So we have 10, which is all of them. Now, if we say that vitamins A is supposed to be larger than zero, we have only 3. So they all have specified the amount of vitamin, but only 3 of them have a value that is greater than zero. You follow me? So the first test is testing for the presence of the attribute. They all have the attribute, but only some of them have a positive value for the attribute. So what we can do in the testing is just to test that it actually has an attribute vitamins A. We have to think about context when we put up these predicates, because when we start the predicate, the context is the food element, which means that we talk about vitamins. We talk about vitamins that are children of food. So it's all in the context of the node where the predicate is defined. And we can search for attributes. So we have some attributes that are, or some measures that are in cups. So if we say where serving, which is, serving. You see that serving is a child of food, so nutrition food having serving, but we want serving units. So, and units is an attribute equals cup. None. Let me see, is that right or did I type in something wrong here? Serving gram. Gram. Tablespoons. Oh, let's try a tablespoon instead. See that we can get it up. TBSP. That's one. And if you want to look at it, it's the hazelnut spread. And we see that his units is in tablespoons. I think that is pretty much where we're going to end today. And then Friday, we're going to go through some more examples. And we will be starting to look into the document object model. A question to you. The next assignment is going to be XML. You're going to write some PHP code to parse XML, and you need to create a database for all the XML data to be stored in. I think I should, the experience from the first assignment is that it may make sense to spend a little bit of time going through and a little bit sharing the idea of what I would like to do. Do you want me to do it this week, or should we just do it on Tuesday so that you can complete the current assignment first, and then we'll start looking at the next assignment next week? Tuesday. Good. Then we spend a little bit of time so that you get into at least understand what I'm thinking or what I'm aiming at. That would help you about. Okay, thank you.